Welcome to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. I'm Tom Keene. Daily, we bring you insight from the best in economics, finance, investment, and international relations. Find Bloomberg Surveillance on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Bloomberg.com, and of course, on the Bloomberg.
Joining us now to continue the conversation on what was agreed or what wasn't agreed over the weekend between the United States and China is Marianne Schneider-Petzinger of Chatham House, and she joins us now. Marianne, good morning to you.
Good morning.
The President of the United States said that China has agreed to reduce and remove tariffs on imported American-made cars. Beijing hasn't said this yet, hasn't confirmed it either. Marianne, have you got an idea on what was actually agreed over the weekend, or are we going to get drip-fed this through the week?
Well, we haven't seen anything official yet. And again, both sides, the United States and China, had statements come out of their G20 summit and the side meeting afterwards, but neither statement specifically mentions those tariffs. It's also quite interesting because, you know, China had earlier in the year lowered its tariffs to 15%, and so the 40% tariffs that you're currently seeing are actually more in effect of the retaliatory tariffs. So the real question is that even if those tariffs are reduced, are they going to be below 15% or above 15%, which if they remain above 15%, it's not really adding that much.
That's a really, really good point. And the other difference between the two statements is one references 90 days and the other one doesn't. Do you just assume there is a 90-day period in which we've got to negotiate this now, Marianne?
Well, I certainly think there is. I mean, President Trump has made it very clear that there is this tight deadline and that there is also, you know, pressure to get quick wins. The real question, though, is, you know, can that happen in 90 days? Because it's not just about tariffs. The real fundamental question is about issues around forced technology transfer, intellectual property theft. And that, I think, has a lot more, you know, long-term implications, and it will take longer than 90 days to come to a resolution on that. So we could see a flare-up, I think, as we're heading into, you know, February of next year.
Marianne, I'm sure it was beaten into you at the Fletcher School that all the negotiations and diplomacy is about incentives. I still don't understand the incentives for the Chinese to be anything but patient and wait out this impatient president. Did you see anything that would change that assumption?
I mean, not really. I mean, there's certainly not just the Chinese, but also others that are adopting this waited out strategy. But now that the Chinese have this breathing space of 90 days, 90 days is not a whole lot. And so, you know, they have said that they're going to really start talking in the future, which is significant because the alternative could have been a further escalation of this trade war. So that is a positive step. But again, the real question is what ultimately is the end game. And here it's not quite clear what the Trump administration is ultimately trying to achieve. Is it just about reducing the trade imbalance with China, or is it about these longer substantial concerns about Chinese practices, or also addressing China Made in China 2025 program? And that for the Chinese really is not negotiable.
So what can the Chinese offer the United States to stop this from escalating once again in 90 days' time, Marianne?
Well, again, it is some of those short wins that they can offer to reduce mostly the United States trade imbalance that they have. And there, the question is, you know, again, the statement is very vague in the sense of covering agricultural products, energy, and industrial tariffs.
Yeah.
But there is no specific list of what products those are. And also, there is no mention, even though they're talking about substantial trade, what quality and quantity we're talking about. So a lot of questions remain. But again, both sides have gotten some breathing space. Both sides are also claiming this as a victory. And compared to the alternative of an escalating trade war, this is a welcome step. And now we just have to make sure that there isn't a further escalation again coming next year.
Marianne, thank you so much. Marianne Schneider-Petzinger, Geoeconomics Fellow at Chatham House in London. It is always important with the terrific communication of the Fed to speak to the presidents, to the governor, to the chairman, rarely, and of course we hear it from Chairman Powell at the Economic Club of New York. And then there is the vice chairman, whether it is Stanley Fischer, Alan Blinder, Alice Rivlin, the vice chairman has a special place, including the newly minted vice chairman, Richard Clarida of Columbia University. Here is Vice Chairman Clarida this morning on trade.
In terms of the outlook for the U.S. Economy, obviously trade's an important part. I don't think we're going there. Obviously, trade's a very important part of the global economy. Right now, I think the U.S. economy is in good shape, and we can talk about, you know, risky scenarios, but I think the baseline outlook's very solid.
Within the trade is the idea of exports and imports of America. How does Fed policy link into these political debates, or do you feel it will be in the future more removed, more sterile to monetary policy?
Well, I'm not going to get into the politics. I think Fed policy is very important in terms of making sure that the U.S. economy achieves maximum employment and stable inflation, and that's really a dual mandate given to the Fed by the Congress, and we're really focusing on what we need to do with our tools to achieve that mandate.
Chairman Powell focused in his speech at the Economic Club of New York on financial stability. Should that be a mandate of your Fed?
Well, the way that I think about financial stability, it's obviously very important, and the Fed has an important role in supervision and regulation. And also, if we achieve, as we are, price stability and full employment, that itself will contribute to financial stability. So I think that's the appropriate balance.
Do we need a new regime at the Fed that looks at the combination of real economic growth and price change?
Well, Tom, I think right now the Fed has a framework that's been in place since 2012, and I think it's serving the Fed well. That said, a lot has changed since 2012. And one thing is, as I think my colleague and friend John Williams emphasizes, that we're in a world of what we call the low R star, low equilibrium riskless rates. And what that means is that in a future downturn, there's less room for conventional monetary policy. And what that means is that central banks need to be just as worried about keeping inflation at target as on going above the target. So I think our current framework serves us well. That said, next year, as we've announced, the Federal Reserve System, including the reserve banks, will be doing an assessment and review of our existing framework, seeking input from a wide range of experts and stakeholders, and we're going to try to get a sense about ways we can perhaps refine our framework.
The Vice Chairman of the Federal Reserve, Richard Clarida, there speaking on Bloomberg Surveillance a little bit earlier. Dropping by after his trip to Buenos Aires, Argentina, Michael McKee, International Economics and Policy Correspondent, joining us on Bloomberg Radio here in New York. Good morning to you, Mike.
Good morning.
We take a symmetrical approach to our inflation target. They've been saying that for a while.
Yeah.
Do they have any buy-in from the market?
It's hard to tell because we haven't been above 2%. The real question is, do we have a practical application of that symmetrical policy? If they go above what they think is the neutral rate, how long do they go above, and do they then come back down? That's always the hard part, is to start coming back down. At what if you're going above neutral to keep inflation down, and inflation starts to fall, then do you start cutting rates because inflation is falling? What's your metric? It hasn't really been tried before.
The conclusion of a lot of market participants over the last week or so is the Federal Reserve has dropped into a lower gear. This is a go slow Fed from now on. Would that be the wrong conclusion, Mike?
It would in a certain sense. I mean, it makes logical sense to think that way. But here's where we are. We came off of zero. From zero to where we are now, it was easy to say the Fed's going to raise rates, because they were well below the neutral rate. They had unusually low interest rates. So for the markets, there was no question. Now the Fed is very close to neutral. They may want to be a little more restrictive for a little while. Rich said that that was a possibility, but they don't want to overshoot. They don't want to send the economy into recession because rates are too tight. So it becomes a month-to-month, data point by data point, look at what's going on in the economy. And if you look at what's going on in the economy now, the Atlanta Fed GDP, latest GDP number, has fallen back to 2.6%. So we've gone from 4% to just over 2%. It would make logical sense that they could slow down, particularly if inflation doesn't pick up. But we aren't going to know. They aren't going to know. And that was the point Vice Chairman Clarida tried to make to you, Tom. They aren't going to know until they get close to the time to make the decision.
That's called data dependency. How far is the market on the dots from the present dots?
Well,
are they like record far? Or are they narrowed? What's the distance?
If you look at what happened last year, they were pretty much on where the market is. The market is already pricing in much lower path for 2019. You have two things happening. Real rates are going up, but inflation break-evens are falling. Now, one of those two things is going to be correct. Either inflation is going to slow or growth is going to be stronger. And so, which one you bet on is what tells you what's happening in the market.
Just quickly, Mike, some scheduling issues that I want some insight from you on. When do you think we can find out when the chairman's testimony to the Joint Economic Committee will be? It was scheduled for Wednesday. Yeah. I imagine that's going to be canceled.
I would imagine it will be postponed, and it's probably, at the moment, the Joint Economic Committee and the Fed are probably negotiating about a second date.
Scott Sumner, Michael Darden.
That's who it was.
Thank you for emailing in. Michael
you
McKee
were
and I were, we had a collective
senior
brain freeze.
Moment. Yes.
Scott Sumner on nominal GDP targeting. Thank you, Michael McKee, for that brain freeze earlier this morning. This is Bloomberg. Always important is Freya Beamish. She's with Pantheon Macroeconomics with a real look to China as well. What is the symbolism, Freya, of yuan at 6.89? It's in seven big figures from a 6.94 or so. Is that for real? Is that a market move? Is that a managed move by China?
I don't see it as a managed move. I think the trade tensions have been weighing very heavily on the currency. Although kind of pulling back from that a little bit, there are serious fundamental reasons why we should have seen the currency weakening over the course of this year. We have a very divergent outlook for monetary policy from the PBOC versus the Fed, following on from your previous conversation there. We do think that the Fed is likely to continue hiking rates. And they have clawed back some of that optionality. But what they were talking about was a broad range there for the natural rate of interest. And that could mean one hike or it could mean five hikes. And given that we've just managed to avoid the tariff hike to 25% in January, the likelihood is that the capacity is going to continue closing and tightening in the U.S. So the Fed is going to continue hiking. And then on the opposite side of that, we have the PBOC, which is doing all it can without actually cutting rates to ease liquidity and to bring about a easier monetary conditions. And those two stances are very divergent. So we have kind of fundamental reasons for the currency to be depreciating. But the news over the weekend is obviously it pulled us back from that a little bit.
And John, the Secretary of Treasury, I believe out on CNBC, maybe this is Fox Biz, I can't keep track. U.S. to make sure, let me say it again, United States to make sure China not depreciating currency. Unbelievable.
The comments continue to come in. I believe the Treasury Secretary is speaking to a group of reporters at the moment outside of the White House. Freya, just to get your thoughts on where we are in 90 days, what is your base case?
Well, at the moment, I have to, of course, there are hurdles. There are big hurdles to be surmounted in terms of an actual deal in reality. But in terms of something that they could call a deal on both sides and that would be acceptable to the media, I'd say that has to be within reach just because of the political lay of the land that Republicans will be looking forward to 2020. And if they're in marginal seats, they won't want to be spiking inflation in the interim. And on the Chinese side, as I said, the growth situation, we don't see any signs yet that growth is stabilizing, and therefore the Chinese are not wanting to escalate matters any further either. So in terms of the 90 days, I would expect there to be something that is either labeled as a deal or that we kick the further tariff hikes into the long grass. But over the longer term, we certainly have these two economies on a collision course still.
So in the short term, the mood music improves. And I want to get a better idea of the next policy lever that the Chinese try and pull to help the domestic economy. What do they do, Freya?
Well, they can't really cut rates at the moment, and at the moment, what they've the interbank rates are sitting there at the bottom of the corridor. They didn't really do anything during the PBOC didn't really do anything during November in terms of injections, but that's because they've already achieved through Q3 a lengthening of maturities that are available in the interbank market through the open market operations that they undertook, and through what was quite a hefty cut in the reserve requirement ratio and previous moves that they've made in terms of accepting, widening the acceptance of collateral in the medium-term lending facility. So they've been actually easing since Q2, really. And if you look at what is, I'd say, the earliest leading indicator of policy or where we're going in terms of Chinese growth and how that feeds through from the PBOC, the earliest leading indicator is generally the change in short-term sovereign.
Well, okay. We got to leave it there. Freya Beamish, thank you so much, with Pantheon Macroeconomics as well. Each path is different. We're spending the next 4 days to reconsider the path of George Herbert Walker Bush. I looked, Pim, at the 22-second film of the dragging of the young pilot out of the Pacific Ocean at Midway. Watch that in entirety. Worth it seeing, folks, I should say, in entirety. But each path is different. And one of the great things about Alan Simpson of Wyoming is his path was a little different. Pim, he was, to be polite, rambunctious.
He was a troublemaker.
He was a troublemaker. He did not grow up with the advantages of President Bush. And yet they served together. They battled together. They had so much in common. And we're thrilled to bring you this morning, nationwide, the senator from Wyoming, who will only and ever be Alan Simpson. Senator Simpson, your thoughts on our 41st president.
I heard what you said about me, and I tell you, think that was funny, didn't you? Well, no, I loved it. Anyway, no, the thoughts, a wave of emotion. We knew it was coming. We all knew it was coming. In fact, 5 years ago, they called me and said, you know, he's having trouble, would like you to speak and so on. It was very, very, very great honor. But then he said, put the harps back in the closet. You remember that one?
Yeah.
Put the harps back in the closet about six times during the last 5 years. But Ann and I saw him this summer in Kennebunkport. He couldn't walk, but he was his charming self. And Ann said, hello there, handsome. How are you? And he gets a big grin. I told him a couple of stories. I said, you're deprived of good, rich stories here. You live in a cocoon. Let me give you a couple. Well, I did. And he threw his head back. God, he loved it. We had a wonderful time. We fished together. We hunted together. We traveled together. We legislated together. There were so many times when I was Bob Dole's assistant, one of the great legislators, Bob Dole. And don't forget, Bob Dole, who had lost to him in the primary, had one of the nicest relationships with Bush that you could imagine.
Well, this goes to, Senator, where I want to go. You guys are from another time in place. Do you have an optimism in this 2018 that we can migrate somewhere back to the Simpson-Dole-Bush grace?
Well, we have to. Unless the Congress wants to continue to be just an absolute laughing stock. I mean, you talk to people out on the road. I mean, I live in Cody, Wyoming, but I'm not in a cave, and I travel a great deal. And for God's sake, they bring up the names. They know who they are. They name them, Democrat and Republican. This guy's a jerk. This guy is a boobblehead. This is one of the worst screwballs on earth, as if they had no function or no brain. So you keep doing what they're doing and laying little traps for each other. That's the thing that's so absolute stupefying. Let's see what we'll do with this. We can get the president to veto this. Oh, we'll get him, won't get. Oh, we'll do this, and that'll be a campaign slot when we diddle this guy the next time. For God's sake, the earth is burning, and they're just trying to figure out how to euchre each other.
All right, so continue down that path. What can we take away, do you believe, from each individual person's memory of President Bush to try to build just what you're describing?
Well, that flag will be down for about 30 days. And it seems to me that during the time the flag is down, people are going to say in about a week, what's the flag down for? They're half mad. Well, it's for George Bush. Well, yeah, Bush, I heard about him. What about him? Yeah, he did some good things. He did some foreign policy things. Oh, yeah, what were they? And then he described them. He did some domestic policy. Well, what were those? Well, Clean Air Act, Americans for Disabilities. I mean, on and on it goes. And they'll say, well, wonder why can't that happen now? And I say because nobody has a degree of the country first. The country, George said, I nearly died for this country. I fought for this country. I didn't fight for the Republicans. I didn't fight for the Democrats. I fought for this country that I love. Whatever happened to that? And that's a damn good question.
There was a report over the weekend that at one time, President Bush was meeting with then the newly elected Congressman Newt Gingrich. And the conversation apparently turned to the differences between the newly elected Congressman and then President Bush. And President Bush responded when asked, what do you fear about us? He said along the lines that he was concerned that at times idealism, in that moment, the specific idealism of the Republicans, that idealism would sometimes get in the way of the smooth running of government. Do you hear that echo in President Bush as a memory?
Well, I could certainly ascribe to it. I do not know of that visit, but that sounds just exactly like George. That would be a great concern to him. He would come away from that kind of meeting, and he'd be puzzled more than anything because his relationships were so deep in the House with Democrats, Rostenkowski, Montgomery. I could name on and on. And so when stuff would hit the fan, George had and the new guys over there were trying to get him. He had a core of people who said, no, you ain't going to get my pal George. He was over here for a while. You know, we know him over here in the House, and we loved him and respected him. And that worked for quite a while. And then when that disappeared and all his chums were gone, then it had to crumble.
Very quickly, Senator, I must have your thoughts with the heritage of Simpson Bowles on where the fiscal policy is now. It is unimaginable to George Herbert Walker Bush. I'm going to suggest it's unimaginable to Alan Simpson. For the next president, for the next Congress, what is the urgency to address our fiscal policy?
Well, go give some kind of voodoo injection to the AARP because they don't give a damn for people under 50. It's a great big group of about 39 million Americans bound together by airline discounts and RV discounts and erectile dysfunction ads. Their sole purpose is to take care of people over 50. That means they don't care about their grandchildren, and they were supposed to talk about the debt and the deficit. Well, hell, they don't know the difference between the debt and the deficit. The deficit is every year. The debt is on automatic pilot, and they've handed it to our grandchildren. You can't even make Social Security system solvent. You can't do something with the unsustainable course of health care. This is absolute madness.
We must leave it there. Alan Simpson, thank you so much. The senator from Wyoming, as we begin to touch upon the life of George Herbert Walker Bush. Thanks for listening to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. Subscribe and listen to interviews on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, or whichever podcast platform you prefer. I'm on Twitter at Tom Keen. Before the podcast, you can always catch us worldwide on Bloomberg Radio.